This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is USA Today, front page and main news. Today is May 7th. I'm Barbara Tobias. First story, most see a guilty verdict for Trump. This is by Susan Page, Rachel Barber, and Sudeeksha Kochi. Guilty? Americans by nearly 3-1 predict that former President Donald Trump will be convicted on all or some of the felony charges he faces in a New York courtroom, an outcome never before seen in U.S. history. In an exclusive USA Today Suffolk University poll, 65% expect a guilty verdict on at least some of the 34 charges that Trump tried to affect the 2016 election by paying hush money to a porn star, then falsified business records to cover it up. Just 23% of those surveyed, disproportionately Trump supporters, say he'll be exonerated. From everything I've read and listened to, there's not been a law broken or anything, end quote, said Jack Honeycutt, 76, a real estate agent from Warner Robins, Georgia, who's a Republican and supports Trump. He called the trial a farce. I hope he won't be convicted, Honeycutt said in a follow-up phone interview, but in New York, you can never tell. Never before has a former president faced criminal charges, and never before has a major party's presumptive presidential nominee been prosecuted as Election Day loomed. Trump supporters are split over whether a conviction is coming. 44% predict a guilty verdict on at least some counts, 43% a not guilty verdict on all of them. But supporters of President Joe Biden, by an almost universal 86-7%, expect Trump to be convicted on at least some counts. It's about time he's gotten caught up and brought to trial, said Beth Corliss, age 77, a retired biomedical engineer from Tucson, Arizona. A political independent and Biden supporter, she said Trump had been involved in financial shenanigans before in his business dealings. It's finally coming out, and I'm glad it is. A poll of 1,000 registered voters by landline and cell phone, April 30th to May 3rd, has a margin of error plus or minus 3.1 percentage points. Overall, 15% expect Trump to be convicted on all 34 felony counts, 50% on some of them, 23% on none of them. Public opinion won't determine the trial's outcome, of course. That will depend on the judgment of 12 jurors who've been listening to testimony at Manhattan Criminal Court, with Trump sitting before them at the defendant's table. But the public's assessment will affect the repercussions afterwards, including whether Americans accept the jury's judgment as just. Trump has railed against the trial, claiming, without evidence, that the charges were engineered by Biden and accusing Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg of political motives. Trump has blasted Judge Juan Merchan and been found in contempt of court for deriding witnesses after being warned not to do so. Trump's complaints have gotten some traction. Overall, those surveyed by 44-39% say the trial hasn't been fair. Independents split 37-37% on the trial's fairness. Among men, white people, Hispanic voters, and seniors 65 and older, more call the trial unfair than fair. That includes an overwhelming 85% of Trump supporters, but just 11% of Biden supporters. It's basically a sham, said Devi Walta, 67, a Republican retiree and Trump supporter from Helena, Montana. If they actually thought that they had a leg to stand on, they would have done this before he was trying to get reelected. Unfair in another way, special treatment for Trump. Some of those surveyed say the unfairness is to Trump's benefit, not his peril. I think it's fair that he's being tried, said Kalima Muhammad, 57, of Tallahassee, Florida, a policy analyst for the state government. She's a Democrat who supports Biden. But it's not fair to the extent that if there were a gag order on anybody else, and if they violated it as often as he does, they would be in jail. Even those who expect a guilty verdict in the legal system aren't sure how much effect it will have on the political campaign. It will only embolden his supporters even more because they'll look upon it as a government taking advantage of Donald Trump, said Stephen Dombrowski, 76, a Democrat retiree from Grand Island, New York. If anything, they'll be more concrete in their support. I don't think he can lose either way. And continuing on, in trial updates, judge weighs jail time for Trump over gag order violation. Judge threatens Trump with jail time and says fines for violations of gag orders not working. This is by Aisha Bagchi, Bart Jansen, and Sudeeksha Kochi. The 12th day of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial began with a threat. Judge Juan Merchan told Trump that the $1,000 fines for gag order violations evidently aren't deterring the former president. For future violations, Merchan said he will have to consider jail. The judge made the statement as he issued a ruling holding Trump in criminal contempt for the 10th violation of the gag order that bars him from commenting on jurors and witnesses. Merchan said that the magnitude of such a decision is not lost on him, but that Trump's violations threaten to interfere with the fair administration of justice. There are many reasons why incarceration is truly a last resort, the judge said. He worries about court officers and the Secret Service, as well as about the broader implications. However, as much as he doesn't want to impose a jail sanction, Merchan told Trump directly that he will, if necessary and appropriate. Last week, the judge found Trump violated the order 9 times, including a series of social media posts. A court spokesperson confirmed to USA Today on Friday that the $9,000 for those violations has been paid. This new violation is based on the presumptive GOP presidential nominee's comments about the jury during a phone interview with a TV program called Just the News, No Noise. According to a transcript the prosecution supplied to the court, Trump said during the call that the jury was picked so fast, 95% Democrats, the area is mostly all Democrat. You think of it as just a purely Democrat area. It's a very unfair situation that I can tell you. Merchan said he couldn't find beyond a reasonable doubt that Trump violated the gag order on 3 other occasions cited by prosecutors. The judge said 2 of these possible violations may be protected political speech, while a 3rd may not have constituted a veiled threat against a witness. It was a dramatic start to a new week of a trial that ended Friday with emotional testimony from Trump's former close confidant, Hope Hicks. Hicks described her initial advice to the 2016 campaign in quotes, deny, 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 end quotes, when a reporter first reached out for comment about the infamous Access Hollywood tape in which Trump boasted that he grabbed women's genitals. Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Prosecutors say he was covering up unlawfully interfering in the 2016 presidential election through a hush money payment from his fixer, Michael Cohen, to porn star Stormy Daniels, who says she had sex with Trump. The former president denies that claim and has pleaded not guilty. For a second time Monday, Trump's son Eric attended the trial. He sat next to Alina Haba, Trump's lawyer for his 2 recent civil trials. Over the weekend, Trump attended the Formula One Miami Grand Prix in Florida with a host of celebrities. Before entering the courtroom, he talked about the news that Columbia University canceled its graduation ceremony because of pro-Palestinian protests against Israel. He blasted Merchan and ignored a question about whether he would testify. Reporters in Miami asked Trump about the trial, but he said he couldn't answer. I have to say, I've got a gag order, Trump said. I can't speak about it. Never happened before, ever. Controller talks Cohen payments. The prosecution then began questioning Jeffrey McConney, the former controller for the Trump Organization. Though McConney left the Trump Organization in February of 2023, the company is paying for his lawyer. McConney said he has not spoken with Trump since retiring. Prosecutor Michael Colangelo took McConney through the nuts and bolts of paying Cohen after the hush money payment. The questioning appeared to be an effort to support the prosecution's allegation that Trump was sending checks to Cohen to reimburse him for the $130,000 hush money payment and falsely labeled those checks as legal expense payments. During opening statements, Trump lawyer Todd Blanche denied the checks were reimbursement to Cohen for the hush money. Asked what Cohen's position was, McConney responded that Cohen would say he was a lawyer, drawing chuckles in the courtroom. At some point, McConney said he learned that Cohen needed to be reimbursed through a conversation with Alan Weisselberg, the Trump Organization's former chief financial officer. Colangelo showed a document labeled Account Activity, indicating that Cohen wired Daniel's lawyer $130,000. Some handwritten notes were related to repaying Cohen, McConney said. The prosecutor then displayed an email from Cohen with a typed-out invoice to Weisselberg The email said, in quotes, "Dear Alan, pursuant to the retainer agreement, kindly remit payments for services rendered for the months of January and February 2017, end quotes. Asked whether he saw a retainer agreement, McConney replied, "I did not." It was a significant moment for the prosecutor's office to prove that the payments were not genuine legal expenses. Cohen continued to send monthly invoices for $35,000, totaling $420,000 for 2017. After the March bill, he emailed McConney, nudging about the payment. McConney responded, "Yes, I'll check status tomorrow. DJT needs to sign check." DJT was Donald Trump, who needed to okay the payment, McConney testified. And our next front page story on USA Today, May 7th. Food was a big way that I didn't fit in. Eating disorder survivors share their journeys to health. This is by Audrey Richardson and Aurora Susanis. A first-time mother tries to conceal her new curves. A teenage boy endlessly compares himself with the bulked-up bodies he sees online. An elderly woman, in an attempt to avoid the ailments that took her mother, grows fragile instead. They all struggle with disordered eating. The Detroit Free Press, part of the USA Today network, spoke with several people about their struggles, triumphs, and paths toward understanding their condition and finally healing. While each story is unique, many share common experiences. Some developed unhealthy habits, such as restriction, limiting what kind of food they eat, how much, or going for long periods without eating. Many acted on societal cues that correlate thinness with health. Others felt pressure to look like the idealized images they flip through the magazines or scroll past on TikTok. Those who sought help said the healthcare system routinely overlooked their struggles and used an industry standard of health, the body mass index. That's a measure of body fat based on a person's height and weight that failed to signal their eating disorders. "It's a number that does a disservice to patients," said Judith Banker, founder and president of the Center for Eating Disorders in Ann Arbor. "People abuse themselves with that number. The medical system abuses people with that number." Banker said, "We should be looking at blood pressure and heart rate and how the internal systems are working, because weight is just a very, very poor proxy for body health." Across the country, 10% of Americans will develop an eating disorder. More than 10,000 people die from one, according to the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. At a time when millions of Americans clamor for appetite-suppressing drugs, when the negative effects of social media on body image cycle through headlines and congressional hearings, and when studies show that pandemic-induced isolation has worsened eating disorders, the people who spoke to the Free Press say they want to share their stories to help others who may struggle to find hope. They also shared, in handwriting on some of their photos, what they wish they knew at the start of their recovery journeys. Samantha Barish, what healthy really looks like. Crisp, tender falafel, aromatic mahadra, delicate dolmas, and warm pockets of wood-fired pita. This is the food that brings Samantha Barish home. But that's not how Barish has always felt. "Food was a big way that I didn't fit in with others growing up," said Barish, 31, who grew up in a Middle Eastern household. The food at Barish's home didn't look like what her classmates ate. It also clashed with the messages she heard about healthy eating. "I remember being at my grandmother's house after I read in one of those silly health magazines about damned rice, and I didn't want to eat white rice," Barish recalled. "I remember not eating the grape leaves that my grandmother made." Barish developed a fixation on food, starting her first diet in the eighth grade and deciding to become a dietitian. But it was in college, while studying to be a dietitian, that her eating disorder worsened. "You come into this with a fascination with food, and then you start to truly think food is the most important thing in the world. It can spiral very, very quickly," Barish said. Barish's journey to recovery began when she started working as a dietitian after college. "I had the realization that no matter how much weight I lost, it would never be enough," she said. Barish now helps others mend their relationships with food and body image at her own practice, Tap Into Nutrition. Barish tells her clients that true health is a way more than a body size. "Some foods have more nutrition than others, but all foods are healthy," Barish said. "If you go to your grandma's house and it's her birthday and she's 90 years old and you guys are eating a birthday cake, eating that cake with your family at that moment is healthy." Fran Betts, Realization, Then Recovery Later in Life. When Frances Betts was 25, her 52-year-old mother, who was a diabetic, died from a heart attack. Betts vowed to avoid the same fate. "I did not want to die when I was 50," Betts said. "I wasn't going to go through life like that." Betts dieted throughout adulthood, the fear of suffering the fate as her mother followed Betts into her 70s. When she decided to cut processed sugar out of her diet, she began to rapidly lose weight. Betts's daughter became increasingly worried about how frail her mother was and pushed her to see a specialist. In doing so, Betts discovered a different danger, eating disorders. "I never thought there was any danger in being too thin. We don't hear that anymore. All we hear about are the diets. I had no idea that people my age had eating disorders," Betts said. Research supports Betts' assessment. Treatment guidelines tend to be based on case studies of adolescents and middle-aged adults. By the time Betts sought help, she was tired frequently and moving slower, signs of malnutrition. "I felt my brain slowing down," Betts said. "It just took me longer to do things. That's when I realized the absolute danger." Starving the body of nutrition can cause parts of the brain to thin, suggesting that people who are heavily restricting are destroying their brain cells and breaking connections between brain cells, according to a 2022 study by the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. The study also found that malnutrition can also cause heart damage, the very thing Betts was trying to avoid. Betts blames her doctors for not realizing how her weight loss could affect her health. "They didn't do a damn thing," Betts said. "That's a remiss on their part. I thought I was doing okay." Betts is working to rebuild the way she thinks about eating, but trying to unwind a lifetime of bad habits can feel overwhelming, she said. Betts, however, said she's working hard toward recovery and that her goal has always been to be with family for as long as possible. J.C. Kirby, a healthy relationship with exercise. J.C. Kirby was 14 years old when he first sought help for binge eating. His primary care physician simply told him to, in quotes, just stop eating. At the time, Kirby was bullied about his weight and appearance, and he spiraled into a deep depression. "I've always used food to cope," said Kirby, now 25, of Clinton Township, Michigan. "The binge eating aspect, the full-blown disorder, was when I was struggling with depression, and I pushed it into it further." For Kirby, cycles of severe restriction and binging started in 2017. The slightest frustration, like hitting a couple of red lights in a row, might trigger a binging episode, Kirby recalled. During a binge, Kirby went to multiple fast food restaurants and gas stations and ordered food from each location. He returned home to sit in his room for days at a time, gorging on all that food, he said. Afterward, Kirby called off work, exercised excessively, and starved himself for days, trying to rapidly purge the calories he had consumed. "You enter sort of a euphoric bubble where the world could literally be ending outside and it wouldn't matter," Kirby said. "But as soon as you take that last bite, it's immediate self-loathing." Though Kirby tried to change his behavior, he didn't know how. "Behind the closed doors of my room, I would try to sort things out and deal with it on my own. But I literally had no sense of coping mechanisms whatsoever," Kirby said. Kirby formed a new path after he began kickboxing, started therapy, and met his fiancée, Chloe. Before, Kirby saw exercise exclusively as a way of purging from binges. "Exercise was about doing something to my body instead of for it," he said. Now Kirby is a fitness trainer at Planet Fitness in Clinton Township, where he teaches his clients how to build healthy relationships with food and exercise. Kirby has also found an outlet through writing. In January, he published a collection of poems titled "To My Eating Disorder," in which he details his struggles and seeks the strength to heal. "I have a lifetime to go dealing with this eating disorder," he said. "One of the biggest points I've learned is, you slip up, it doesn't mean you relapse. I'm just taking it moment by moment." Dana Demeter, Finding Beauty in a New Body. Dana Demeter was 5 when a doctor told her mother Demeter was overweight. After that, sweets were off limits. She hadn't thought much about her appearance before, but it wasn't long until she started to compare her body to those around her. By the time she turned 12, Demeter had developed bulimia. I learned about purging in health class, and I thought, that could be a good way to lose weight, said Demeter, remembering that it became a pattern for her when a friend did it too. Demeter started to cycle through restriction and binge eating, which got worse in college. Hoping to start a new chapter after graduating, Demeter managed to quit purging on her own and thought she was cured. About a decade later, Demeter became a mother, which brought another set of pressures. It's normal to talk about weight gain during pregnancy, said Demeter, now 39 and a mother of three. Then after you have the baby, there's very little talk about healthy weight loss or just being okay with your new body. When her mother died in 2020, Demeter's disorder worsened and she turned to food to cope with her grief. Demeter sought therapy in 2022 after realizing that the way she talked and thought about food could hurt her firstborn daughter, Frankie, then 6 years old. I would catch myself saying things that were said to me and having to stop myself, she said. It wasn't just about me anymore. With therapy, Demeter has learned how to think and talk about food. I've realized weight loss isn't always healthy, Demeter said. I've always been told that I would be beautiful if I was thin. I'm not, but I am beautiful. Alicia Washington, reconnecting with beloved foods. Growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, Alicia Washington remembers being one of the few black kids in her community. Nobody is saying anything to me, but I just felt like I'm not supposed to be here, Washington said. You just feel like you're very different from the people around you, and you're just trying to do everything possible to assimilate. For Washington, 30, assimilating meant changing her body. Fitting in meant literally shrinking myself down to fit down to what everyone else around me is, said Washington, who now lives in Detroit. That included rejecting the food her family loved, fried chicken, bread, collard greens, ham. It felt like my food didn't have value to the health-conscious people, and I was ashamed, Washington said. The food that I loved, the food that my mom made for me, the food that was at my family celebrations wasn't good. Washington struggled the most when she was at college. She frequently skipped meals and once fainted in the cafeteria. Perversely, the worse I was taking care of my body, the more positive feedback I got, which feeds into the cycle of, I should keep doing it because everyone's giving me compliments. Washington said, I don't blame anyone for doing it. It's just our social conditioning. Washington sought help in her mid-20s. The COVID-19 pandemic had set in, and she had recently gotten married and bought a house with her husband. She thought about their future together and the family they want to build. Washington's therapist suggested she start working with a nutritionist. Washington agreed, but previous experiences with healthcare professionals made her cautious. Doctors tend to start conversations about weight loss before they know anything about me. In 2022, Washington began working with a dietitian who steered her away from focusing on weight loss and toward mending her relationships with food and eating. Now, Washington is reconnecting with the foods that her family loves, even as she fights an inner voice telling her she's not good enough, that she needs to change. It's one of those things where you want to buck the system and be like, screw this. But at the same time, you know you're a person and exist in a world in which certain bodies are praised and other bodies are punished. McKenna Silverman, always reaching for recovery. Green light, yellow light, red light. McKenna Silverman, 22, of Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, imagines a stoplight when she thinks of where she's at in terms of her eating disorder. At a green light, Silverman glides, free from the weight of her illness. When she hits yellow, she struggles with negative thoughts, but can move forward. At red, Silverman's eating disorder brings her life to a halt. Silverman was in the red in the fall of 2022 when she lost the ability to walk and fainted in front of her young cousins. I was bedridden, she said. I had to sit down to brush my teeth. During Silverman's childhood and teenage years, she often saw her mom receive compliments about her body. Silverman wanted the same, she said. If I had that much self-control, then people would be saying that to me too, Silverman recalled thinking at the time. Silverman carried her search for validation to Michigan State University. I noticed the type of girls that made it farther socially, Silverman said. To fit that mold, Silverman dyed her hair blonde and started to pair restriction with intense exercise to lose weight. After a year, Silverman had isolated herself from friends and family to avoid their concern and was dizzy and was aching from undereating. In October of 2022, Silverman's friends held an intervention, gentle but insistent that she get help. They persuaded her to seek treatment. I realized I was sacrificing my friends and my family, Silverman said. I didn't want that for myself anymore. But the intensive inpatient program Silverman sought was hard to find. C.S. Mott Children's Hospital had a 7-month waiting list. Silverman researched several other inpatient treatment facilities, trying to find one her family's insurance would cover. In December of 22, Silverman found Focus Integrative Centers in Tennessee and spent 2 months receiving inpatient treatment there. Silverman credits Focus with saving her life. Silverman continues therapy with a care team and says she lately finds herself somewhere between yellow and green lights. Last year, she reached one of her biggest goals, attending one of the Taylor Swift concerts in Detroit with friends, the same ones who intervened to stop Silverman's spiral 7 months before. I stood and screamed for 3 hours straight. I thought, this is what recovery feels like. Green light. And next front page story, uncomfortable conversations. Should bridesmaids say, I do, to costly weddings and added responsibilities? Be honest and upfront to help maintain friendships, expert says. This is by Betty Lynn Fisher. The dilemma, being a bridesmaid today is not the same as it was when I was in my early 20s and when I got married nearly 29 years ago. My bridesmaids bought a dress. Okay, I now admit it was ugly. I had a bridal shower in my maid of honor's family's basement, and I honestly can't remember if I had a bachelorette party. This was definitely before there were big blowout destination festivities. Being a bridesmaid is more expensive now. These days, being a bridesmaid can get very expensive, especially if the ceremony and prenuptial festivals are out of town, adding even more costs on top of the bridal party attire and other expenses. Can or should you turn down an invitation to stand beside your friend at the altar? My 27-year-old niece and I were comparing notes recently when she was telling me about an extravagant March destination wedding where she was one of 13 bridesmaids. Yes, you heard that right. She learned in a bridesmaid Zoom call, the first of several, that she and other bridesmaids were responsible for tasks normally handled by the bride or a wedding planner. For instance, my niece and the future sister-in-law were in charge of planning the rehearsal dinner, and my niece was also in charge of coordinating reception drinks. Other bridesmaids were tasked with booking the DJ or arranging for hair and makeup on the wedding day for $180 to be paid by each bridesmaid. In my head, I was like, I don't want to do this. Hire somebody to do this for you, my niece told me. But she put on a smile and said yes, since other bridesmaids, most of whom she didn't know, were enthusiastically accepting the duties. I think she was trying to save money and DIY it, so wanted help with everything, but we really didn't have a choice, my niece said, adding that the group didn't receive an accurate breakdown of all the costs. I feel like that's a lot to put on somebody else. When I finally tallied up all my niece had spent being a bridesmaid, between the dress and alterations, travel to 3 different places for a bachelorette trip, bridal shower, and destination wedding, and a lot of other expenses, I asked if she wanted to know. No, she laughed nervously, but yes. $3,100. That's a lot, she said. How much money should you budget as a bridesmaid? While the bride may have been a bit over the top, my niece's dilemma was not that unusual. The costs and responsibilities of being a bridesmaid have exploded in recent years. The Knot, an online wedding resources website, has an article outlining costs for bridesmaids that can top $3,430 with the destination bachelorette party, bearing the biggest price tag at an average of $1,300 per person. A LendingTree survey in 2021 said 1/3 of bridal party members went into debt for their friend's wedding, and 68% used a credit card for bridal party expenses, with 37% charging more than $1,000. Peer pressure has turned into a common thing for bridesmaids. The pressure to say yes to your friend, even if it puts the bridesmaid in a financial bind or worse, in debt, is high, my niece said. She spent $1,000 on a 4-day destination bachelorette party in Las Vegas. That included a $140 per person Sunday brunch with a pre-planned menu. My niece has some dietary restrictions, so she couldn't eat most of the food, but she felt she couldn't turn down the invite out of fear she'd be left behind in her hotel room. Even once the bridesmaids got to the weekend of the wedding, there was no hotel block set aside, so the bridal party or guests could get a discounted rate. There was also no transportation provided for the bridal party. My niece and others had to use ride-hailing apps to get themselves to hair and makeup appointments, the church for the wedding, and then the reception. Here's the final tally of her expenses. $140, dress. $60, dress alterations. $300, fly to bridal shower. $50, bridal shower gift. $1,000 for Las Vegas bachelorette trip. $600, airfare for niece and her boyfriend to fly to destination wedding. $500 for hotel for the wedding. $180, $90 each for hair and makeup on the wedding day. $50 boat activity pre-wedding day. $100 wedding gift. $120 for Uber rides from the hotel to the makeup appointment, then to the church, onto the reception, and then back to the hotel. Total, $3,100. Honestly, I feel like saying no could ruin a friendship. I asked my niece if she would have said yes to being a bridesmaid if she knew she would have to spend $3,100. She said she would, though it was a hit to her finances. If I had more than one of these a year, I wouldn't be able to do it, she said. I would probably have to say no, and I would probably feel embarrassed. It just puts you in a weird position. My niece shared a text thread with some girlfriends she had after our conversation. One friend said she was on her 11th bachelorette trip, so I would hate to do all the math on all mine. Another friend said, I feel like it needs to become a new social norm to tell your bridal party up front what the financial commitment is going to be. Another replied, honestly, I feel like saying no could ruin a friendship. One friend said she's never said no to being in the wedding, but she's opted out of bachelorette trips. Experience makes niece a more sensitive bride-to-be. My niece is now a bride-to-be. She's already cost-conscious and considerate, but her bridesmaid's experience has also made her a more sensitive bride. She's only having two bridesmaids and plans on paying for their hair and makeup. She said she's also been saving up like crazy because I want to pay for the bachelorette trip, though her friends will have to pay for their flights. Why? I asked her. It's an unnecessary trip that everybody has to go on, and it's really for me, she said. She's also looking for a less expensive hotel as a second choice for budget-conscious guests from out of town, and she's not doling out any jobs to her bridesmaids. We've hired a wedding planner, she said. Expert, duties and expenses exponentially larger. The expert advice? Being a bridesmaid has indeed changed, and it is causing financial stress and straining friendships, said Marissa Forsythe, business development director for Junebug Weddings, an online wedding inspiration resource and vendor directory. The expenses that go along with not only being a bridesmaid, but being a friend of a bride are just exponentially larger than they used to be, say, even 10 years ago, said Forsythe, who has been involved in the wedding industry for about a decade. I think the rise of destination weddings, destination bachelorette parties are a thing now, too. There are also costs for gatherings like a lingerie shower, a stock-the-bar party, a co-ed trend to stock the engaged couple's at-home liquor supply and engagement celebrations, said Forsythe. Forsythe said bridesmaids are spending anywhere from $1,500 to $3,000. A few years ago, one of Forsythe's friends was in 12 weddings in 1 year. She couldn't go on vacation with us or have time off because everything was dedicated to these wedding weekends, Forsythe said. How do you have the awkward conversation about costs? At Junebug, the advice is be honest and upfront. Don't come up with an excuse of why you can't be at the wedding. That's not related to finances, Forsythe said. If the friendship is strong enough, it shouldn't affect the friendship in a negative way, she said, though she acknowledges broaching the subject is much easier said than done. Just as important, Forsythe said, it's not to flat out pass on the chance to be in the wedding without first calculating your own budget and talking to the bride about your concerns. Maybe you attend the destination wedding, but skip the destination bachelorette party. Maybe you ask the bride if you can buy your dress off a secondhand website or do your own hair and makeup, she said. Forsythe said it breaks her heart to hear comments like those from my niece's friends, saying they feel like being honest about the financial strain and saying no to being a bridesmaid would ruin a friendship. Don't try to put on a fake facade that everything is okay, she said. Showing a little vulnerability can be beneficial to the friendship too, Forsythe said. You might find out that your friend is also having financial struggles. Forsythe also advises tackling the conversation early in the process. You don't want to be the person who everybody assumes is attending the bachelorette party and then back out last minute. And then it causes everybody else to have a bigger bill, she said. Do you still have to get the bride a gift and pay other expenses? Forsythe said the bride should make clear to everybody involved what she's expecting. Some brides say, no gifts, because you being there is my gift, she said. That takes the pressure off the bridesmaids in a really easy way. A group gift among bridesmaids where everyone is contributing $40 or $50 could also work, Forsythe said. Also, do-it-yourself or homemade gifts, or buying something small but special on Etsy is still super meaningful, something that you dedicate your time to without having to put a big budget toward. Responsibility to outline expenses is on the bride. The bride should also outline the budget and responsibilities she's assigning her bridesmaids, said Forsythe. Map out expenses as soon as you can for bridesmaids, so there are no surprise $140 brunches during an already expensive destination bachelorette party, Forsythe said. We can't be afraid to say no and be honest. We want to say yes, but we can't be afraid to say no, said Forsythe of accepting bridal party invitations. It's okay to say, I'd love to do this. I'm going to have to be excluded from this point, but I'm so happy to be a part of your wedding day, and I can't wait to see you walk down the aisle. The conversation may be difficult, but if the outcome is going to be way more negative than positive to participate in this wedding, you owe it to yourself to be honest, she said. This isn't the end-all, be-all for your friendship, even though it feels like it. And next on the inside page of this May 7th USA Today, Democrats want answers on nursing homes, seek info over executive pay and stock buybacks. This article is by Ken Alltucker. Three U.S. senators and two U.S. representatives have called out the corporate spending of three large nursing home companies amid the industry's opposition to the Biden's administration rule to set minimum staffing levels. In letters sent Sunday to executives of three large chains, Senators Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Richard Blumenthal, and Representatives Jan Schakowsky and Lloyd Doggett questioned the nursing home spending on executive compensation, stock buybacks, and dividends as the industry protests a new staffing rule for nursing homes. The letter, signed by the four Democrats and Sanders, a Vermont independent, said National Healthcare Corps, the Ensign Group, Inc., and Brookdale Senior Living, Inc. spent nearly $650 million on executive pay, stock buybacks, and dividends since 2018. The lawmaker said such spending undermines the claim that nursing homes cannot afford to pay for enough staff to meet the new rule. Last month, the Biden administration announced a new rule that requires nursing homes that receive federal payments for care to meet minimum staffing requirements for registered nurses and nurses' aides. The rule requires nursing homes to provide each resident a minimum of 0.55 hours of care from a registered nurse and 2.45 hours from a certified nursing assistant every day. The minimum staffing level will be phased in over 2 to 3 years. Biden administration officials said the measure is necessary to limit cases of resident neglect or delays in care, a lingering concern that was exposed when more than 200,000 nursing home residents and staff died from COVID-19 in the first 2 years of the pandemic. A USA Today analysis found just 160 skilled nursing facilities out of about 14,500 would have met the new requirements every day last summer. The nursing home industry group, American Healthcare Association, vowed to defend nursing homes and explore all available options in response to the federal rule. Mark Parkinson, president and CEO of AHCA, said the rule creates an impossible task for nursing homes, which would need to hire hundreds of thousands of additional caregivers amid a nationwide shortfall. Even representatives of nonprofit nursing homes and facilities said the new minimum federal staffing standards will be difficult to implement. Leading Age, an association of nonprofit providers of aging services, said workforce shortage and the cost of recruiting, training, and retaining staff could make it difficult for facilities to meet the federal staffing rule. This rule's outcome may well exacerbate existing issues older adults and families face in trying to access nursing home care. Limited admissions, fewer beds, and worse yet, nursing home closures, said Katie Smith Sloan, president and CEO of Leading Age. Despite industry concerns about nursing and caregiver shortages, the three senators and two representatives said the number of nurses passing licensing tests has grown steadily since 2017. Turnover is high due to poor working conditions, understaffing of facilities, and low pay, conditions that you are in position to rectify, the letter said. According to the letter, the three publicly traded nursing home chains spent the following amounts from 2018 through 2023 on non-care expenses. National Healthcare Corp spent more than $210 million on stock buybacks and dividends and $26.5 million on executive compensation. Ensign Group spent $145.2 million on stock buybacks and dividends and $144.3 million on executive compensation. Brookdale Senior Living spent $67.7 million on stock buybacks and dividends and $48.9 million on executive compensation. The senators and representatives demand the three companies answer how they determine executive pay and bonuses and whether such compensation is influenced by quality of care or profits. The letter also seeks answers on the three companies' average pay and tenure for their registered nurses and nurse aides. The letters also demand the companies provide any complaints or comments submitted by their nurses over staffing levels and pay. The lawmakers also ask the companies to detail lobbying or advocacy spending, including payments that may have been used to lobby against a minimum federal staffing rule. Next, Maine commencement canceled at Columbia. Emory relocates its graduation events by Christopher Kahn. Columbia University announced Monday it will not hold its Maine commencement ceremony following weeks of campus protests over the war in Gaza. In a news release, the university said it chose to make school-level ceremonies the centerpiece of this year's graduation instead of a large formal ceremony. The university said it had consulted with student leaders in deciding how to handle graduation. The majority of the ceremonies, which had been set to take place on its Upper Manhattan campus, where most of the protests have taken place, will take place at the Maine Athletic Complex, about 5 miles away. On the same day, Emory University in Atlanta announced a relocation of its various graduation events, including the school's Maine commencement ceremony. Instead of taking place on the campus quad, the university-wide commencement ceremony will occur at an indoor arena in Duluth, Georgia, more than 20 miles northeast of campus. Please note that this decision was not taken lightly. It was made in close consultation with the Emory Police Department, security advisors, and other agencies, each of which advised against holding commencement events on our campuses, the university said in a statement. Both Columbia and Emory, where pro-Palestinian protests have roiled campus and led to arrests, cited safety concerns in their statements on the changes. Monday's announcements from Columbia and Emory come as universities across the country and overseas continue to grapple with pro-Palestinian protests on campus. Over the weekend, police responded to several college campuses. Students in Michigan and Indiana interrupted and walked out of graduation ceremonies. Last month, the University of Southern California became the first university to cancel its main commencement in the aftermath of large pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Alan M. Garber, the president of Harvard, demanded in a statement on Monday that protesters break up a pro-Palestinian encampment in Harvard Yard or face a potential ban from campus. In a statement published on Monday, Garber said those who participate or perpetuate the encampment's continuation will be referred for involuntary leave from their schools. Students placed on involuntary leave must leave campus until reinstated and will not be able to sit in for exams or reside in on-campus housing. Garber cited safety concerns as well as the upcoming graduation ceremonies as reasons for the university's harsher stance on the encampment. The members of the class of 2024 deserve to enjoy this milestone uninterrupted and unimpeded, Garber's statement said. It would be especially painful if students who graduated from high school or college during the pandemic were denied a full graduation ceremony for a second time. Police at the University of California, San Diego on Monday began breaking up a pro-Palestinian encampment on the school's main campus as operations were suspended and classes were moved online. Videos circulating on social media showed police in riot gear taking down tents and carrying away people handcuffed with zip ties. Events, classes, and other operations, except for housing and dining on UC San Diego's West Campus, were suspended due to police activity, the university announced. On Sunday, Chancellor Pradeep K. Khosla said the encampment was illegal and called on protesters to peacefully disperse. He said communication between university leadership and the demonstrators had broken down and that the encampment had tripled in size since May 1st. In the last week, the encampment has limited free movement on campus, created a checkpoint for entry into the camp, and denied access to the fire marshal and health inspectors, the statement said. As time passes, the threat and potential for violent clashes increases. Students at Princeton University began a hunger strike in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza, calling for the Ivy League school to divest from Israel. A statement from organizers said participants would abstain from all food and drink, except water, until their demands were met. We commit our bodies to the liberation of Palestine. Princeton, hear us now. We will not be moved, the statement said. The university told CNN that university physicians were monitoring the group and were offering medical support. The university did not immediately respond to a request for comment from USA Today. Princeton is not the first university where hunger strikes over the war in Gaza have occurred. Last month, students at the University of South Florida launched such a strike for more than 2 weeks before it ended after two students were hospitalized. Hunger strikes also occurred at Yale and McGill universities. Pro-Palestinian encampments also have been erected on the campuses of Oxford and Cambridge in the UK, as students and organizers call on the universities to sever financial ties to Israel. Oxford Action for Palestine, the group leading the demonstration at Oxford, said in a statement that an encampment was established at 4 a.m. Monday on the lawn outside of Pitts River Museum on the university's campus. At Cambridge, students set up tents and banners outside King's College on Monday. Cambridge for Palestine, the organizers leading the protest, demanded a meeting with the school's leadership. And next, Hamas says it accepts proposal for ceasefire, no response from Israel to deal by Egypt, Qatar. This is by John Bacon. Hamas said Monday that it had accepted a Gaza ceasefire proposal from Egypt and Qatar, but details were not immediately available, and it's not clear whether Israel had agreed to the terms. The militant group said in a statement that its chief, Ismail Haniyeh, had informed Qatar's prime minister and Egypt's intelligence chief of its acceptance of their proposal. The announcement came hours after Palestinians were warned to evacuate parts of the southern Gaza city of Rafah as Israel prepared for an attack certain to worsen an acute humanitarian crisis. An Israeli army spokesperson asked about the truce proposal, said only that his government closely examines every response to ceasefire proposals and is exhausting every possibility on negotiations and the return of hostages. An Israeli official told Reuters the deal approved by Hamas appeared to be a softened version of an Egyptian proposal that included far-reaching conclusions that Israel could not accept, Reuters reported. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said the Hamas announcement could be a ruse intended to make Israel appear to be the side blocking a deal. Meanwhile, a senior Israeli official who spoke to the New York Times on condition of anonymity said Hamas had not agreed to the terms of the latest Israeli proposal. Israel began its assault on Gaza in response to the Hamas-led attack October 7th, in which almost 1,200 people were killed and more than 200 hostages were taken, according to Israeli tallies. More than 34,600 Palestinians have been killed, and more than 77,000 have been wounded, according to Gaza's health ministry. Rafah, a city of about 275,000 before the war, has been overwhelmed by up to 1 million additional residents who fled fighting elsewhere in the embattled enclave. About 100,000 Palestinians are believed to live in the evacuation area. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly warned that an attack on Rafah was necessary to complete the task of crushing Hamas. Netanyahu said as recently as Sunday he would negotiate for a ceasefire, but that the war won't end until Hamas has been destroyed. The Israeli military calls on residents in the eastern neighborhoods of Rafah to temporarily evacuate to the expanded humanitarian area, a few miles outside the city, the military said in a statement. The warnings were issued through text messages, phone calls, and Arabic media broadcasts. Thousands of residents were crowding streets with cars, pickups, and mule-drawn cords, urged on by blasts heard across eastern parts of the city. Evacuees were warned not to migrate toward Egyptian or Israel borders. The White House issued a statement saying the administration has made its opposition to a ground invasion of Rafah clear to the Israeli government. We continue to believe that a hostage deal is the best way to preserve the lives of the hostages and avoid an invasion of Rafah, where more than 1 million people are sheltering, the statement said. Those talks are ongoing now. President Joe Biden and Netanyahu later spoke by phone, marking Holocaust Remembrance Day and discussing talks aimed at the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas. The readout's only mention of Rafah was that the president reiterated his clear position on Rafah. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell denounced Israel's evacuation orders, saying they portend the worst, more war and famine. He called on Israel to drop plans for a ground offensive, saying the international community can and must act to prevent such scenario. Next, La Niña will be making an impact on storms by Doyle Rice. While this may sound like a small change in temperature, it can cause significant changes in the weather patterns around the globe. Brian Leda, AccuWeather meteorologist on water cooling 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit below average for La Niña to be declared. You'll be hearing a lot about La Niña in the months ahead if the climate pattern forms. Federal scientists expect it will sometime this summer. It now has a 60% chance of occurring, and experts say it would have an impact on the Atlantic hurricane season and the nation's weather next winter. The La Niña would replace what has been a historically strong El Niño, forecasters said. There is a historical tendency for La Niña to follow strong El Niño events, the Climate Prediction Center said in a recent forecast. What is La Niña? La Niña is a natural climate pattern marked by cooler than average seawater in the central and eastern Pacific Ocean. When the water cools at least 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit below average for 3 straight months, a La Niña is declared. While this may sound like a small change in temperature, it can cause significant changes in the weather patterns around the globe, said AccuWeather meteorologist Brian Latta. It is one of the main drivers of weather in the United States, especially during the late fall, winter, and early spring. It's the opposite of the more well-known El Niño, which occurs when Pacific Ocean water is at least 0.9 degrees warmer than average for 3 months. The most recent El Niño peaked in December and will go down as one of the 5 strongest in history, the World Meteorological Organization said. According to the Climate Prediction Center, La Niña can contribute to an increase in Atlantic hurricane activity by weakening the wind shear over the Caribbean Sea and tropical Atlantic basin, which allows storms to develop and intensify. It's one of the reasons forecasters have predicted a hyperactive hurricane season in the Atlantic basin this year, with one forecast expecting as many as 33 named storms. An average year sees 14. Wind shear refers to the change in wind speed and direction between roughly 5,000 and 35,000 feet above the ground, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said. Strong vertical wind shear can rip a developing hurricane apart or even prevent it from forming. This is what can happen in the Atlantic during an El Niño when Atlantic hurricane activity is suppressed. While La Niña tends to increase hurricanes in the Atlantic, it also tends to decrease their numbers in the eastern and central Pacific Ocean basins. La Niña and El Niño typically have minimal impact on summer weather in the U.S., other than the effect on hurricanes. Winter is the one season when they have the most impact. A typical La Niña winter in the U.S. brings cold and snow to the Northwest and unusually dry conditions to most of the southern states, according to the Climate Prediction Center. The Southeast and Mid-Atlantic also tend to see higher than average temperatures during a La Niña winter. Meanwhile, New England and the upper Midwest into New York tend to see lower than average temperatures, the Weather Channel said. That's all the time we have today. I'm Barbara Tobias. It's Tuesday, May 7th, and this has been the front page and main news of USA Today. Thanks for listening.